but it's for His glory that I say it. God bless you. Now, in the 13th chapter of Hebrews, I wish to read some scripture. Because no service is complete without the reading of God's Word. My word will fail, everybody else's word will fail, but God's word will never fail. Hebrews 13:10-14. We have an altar whereof they which have no right to eat which serve the tabernacle, for the bodies of those beasts whose blood is brought unto the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burnt without the camp. Therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people, with his own blood suffered without the gate. Let us go forth therefore unto him without the camp, bearing his reproach. Here's my text. For here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. I imagine my voice has a little blast in there, and I'll get back. Can you hear all right up in the balcony, up in the second balcony, all right? What I wish to speak on is here we have no continuing city. To kind of back up and you pray with me. There's no one that I think of when Abraham left the city of Ur and the land of Chaldean, he was seeking a city whose builder and maker was God. Now there was something in Abraham that he could see that great city of Ur, and he knew that that very thing that made people colonize together, there was bound to be a city somewhere that was typed off of. And by instinct, or by the leading of the Holy Spirit, he hunted that city whose builder and maker was God. And he sojourned in the strange land, professed to be pilgrims and strangers, seeking this city, and dwelling in tents with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so, then, we see that city. There's no matter how many places you ever roam, no matter how far you go, there's no place like home. Is that right? How many here today is away from home? Let's see your hand. Just away from home. Oh, my. I wish I could sing. I'd sing, we're pilgrims and strangers seeking a city to come. Being ever so humble, there's no place like home. Let's take a little trip back home. Would you like to do that? I believe everyone here would like to take a trip home, wouldn't you? Just like to go back home. There's no place that you'll ever go that'll ever seem like that lovely little old city you lived in or little old dwelling place out in the country. For myself, I want to walk back down the road just this afternoon with each one of you, taking a little evening stroll to look view the things over. The first thing that comes into my mind this time is a little humble home built out in the country with a broom sage field and some old apple trees standing around where my father and mother and their little family live. A little humble place indeed. We were very, very poor. Daddy had a hard time. He was a very poor man. He worked for 75 cents a day in log woods. My father had a bad habit, drinking. I'm sorry to have to say that, but that's truth. And my father died in my arms. I see my daddy work so hard till when he would come in, his back would be sunburned until his shirt would be sticking to his back, and mother would have to take and clip the shirt loose from his back. I don't care what he done, he's my daddy. I'm not ashamed of my father. I love my daddy. He's gone on today, but he's still daddy. And young people remember. If you're fortunate enough today to have a daddy and a mother living, love them. Honor them. The hour will come, and you're thanked to the greatest people in the world if you don't now. And don't never, little fellows, don't never give this slandering word, old man and old woman. That's not the old man and old woman. That's daddy and mother. And some of these days when they go out of the room, the casket of flowers, you hear them lower down to the ground, the pastor say, ashes to ashes and dust. It won't be the old man then, or it won't be the old woman. It'll be mother, and you'll be wringing your hands and crying. That's right. Now, while she's a-living, give her flowers now, and give Dad his flowers. That's right. Now, and the best flower you can give him is obey him. And that's the first promise in the Bible, the first commandment of the promise. Honor thy father and mother, which may lengthen the days upon the earth that the Lord giveth thee. My daddy worked on a farm, I remember Mother, the furniture we had in the house was the old hickory bottom chairs. How many remembers the old hickory bottom chairs, Rap? Well, I'm not the only country person in here, am I? And we had an old kerosene lamp with a big old hoot owl on the chimney. Remember that old owl? It used to be the one I had to clean it because my hand was so little I could clean the chimney. And we had an old cook stove in the kitchen, and Pop would cut the wood, and we'd bring it in and lay it behind the stove, and us little kiddies would help him saw it up. And we had a table, and behind the table was a bench. Daddy took a piece off of a barn and made a bench that we all, we little boys would go sit on there. We only had three chairs. And so we would get on, and I remember the cabin, the front part of it, it had a floor. It had a room in front and a little half room in the back. And we had one of those little old, we call them monkey stoves or laundry stoves, set up on a stump. And Mother cooked from there, and she'd holler, "Dinner's ready." And there's about five of we little Branhams. We'd run in there and wash our face and slick that hair down and jump up behind the table in one great big old pot dinner cooked in an old three-legged kittle. How many remember them? Say, I just love to have a dinner out of one right now. And she'd take and get beef and make mulligan stew. How many know what mulligan stew is? I'm not the only Irishman here then, am I? So they'd put the mulligan stew in there, and we had, my plate was a tin plate. Frankly, it was a big bucket lid that had turned over, so I'd get a good measure every time the cup went out and dipped out the mulligan stew, and we'd bake cornbread in a pan. How many remembers old cornbread baked in a pan? Cut it in the middle, put it on, and I sat next to Daddy because every person broke his own bread. And so when he come by, I'd break the corner off because it had more crust on it. And so I sure like that, yes. Yes, sir, I sure do. I've eaten many good places, and some of the best places, I guess, in the nation, and minister friends of mine have taken me to dinner, which I'm very, very thankful. But friends, I'd give everything I ever had or ever will have if I could sit behind that old table one more time and look at my daddy sitting there and eat some mulligan stew with him. I'll never do it no more. That's right, it's done forever. Enjoy your childhood, young people. Love God. See all my brothers sit around there, the little healthy-looking things, some of them's in eternity. I can never do that no more, for here we have no continuum in the city, but we seek him one to come. I used to see my daddy when he would come in. He's a little fellow about my size, but strong built. And he would wind up his sleeves like that, and we had out the old apple tree, they had a wash pan sitting out there with an old piece of a glass, was drove up in the tree in a towel made out of a meal sack, and we'd go out there and wash this old bench, and then we'd clean up on the outside of the little bench around the tree. I'd see Daddy when he'd be combing his black wavy hair, and the muscles would just wad under his arm. I thought, ooh, my daddy will live to be 1,000 years old, I think. I admired my daddy, and I think how strong he is. I said, my, he'll live and live and live and live because he's so strong. He died at 52. For here we have no continuing city. Now I thought, oh, that house, how big. Beneath it was logs and a big kind of slab board on the outside. I thought, oh, how that house will stand for hundreds of years. Today there's a housing project there. Here we have no continuing city, but we're seeking one to come. That's right. I passed by just before coming here. I just saw a great swelling in my heart. Oh, God, how can this 20 years make such a difference in a place? But here we have no continuing city. We're seeking one to come. And I thought of Daddy and all. So I remember every Saturday night we'd go to town and pay the grocery bill. And every time we'd pay the grocery bill, Mr. Grower would give us, the groceryman, give us a little sack of candy. I think our grocery bill run to the extent of $3 a week. And my, Dad only made about $4.50. So Mom would get some goods that... My wife's sitting here. I'm afraid to say what kind of goods that was because I make a mistake on it every time. Anyhow, some kind of that little stuff, you know, what they used to make shirts out of. And I remember one time at my church, I said, one of the worst I ever was gotten at my church, I was going to have a humble night on Wednesday night, and I said, and my choir was all sitting behind me, I said, and that's Gangham, that's right, it isn't Gangham. And I said, and I was trying to think of that, and there's a little place down the road called Gangham Cottages. And I was trying to think of that, and I said, I'm sure to make a mistake when I say that. So I had a little girl by the name of Irene Weishart. sing in the choir. I said, now, Sister Wiseheart, when I back, if I forget about it, you tell me what that was. And so I didn't understand anything about goods like that. And I said, now, Wednesday night is humble night here at the tabernacle. I said, now, all you brothers, wear your work clothes, your overalls. I'm going to preach you my overalls. And I said, you all come out with your overalls, and all you women wear your... I said, well, I back, and she said, get. I said, your greyhound dresses. Oh, my. That was about the worst I ever was gotten. And everybody started laughing at me, and I thought, well, I guess I done said it. So I said, ever what that goods is like on this little cottage down here. Then one night, I was run home, I was patrolling. I used to carry those great big old red handkerchiefs. When you hunt, you know you have to have a red handkerchief. And I'd carry one in my pocket. And one night I run in, we lived in a little two-room cabin. And I run across the street real quick to church. I was late, and I run across the street real quick, you know, and I dressed in the room and changed clothes. And I was over there just preaching away, you know, and I got to perspiring. I reached back and got this handkerchief, you know, and I started shaking it like this. And I looked at that big old red handkerchief. I see my wife look at me, and I said, oh, well, I said, I'm afraid of them little ones, afraid I'd swallow her. And that was about the two of the worst I ever was gotten in church. But I remember Daddy would take us down on Saturday night and pay the grocery bill and get those little old sack of candy. And we had a little old Jersey wagon. You all call them out here buckboards, I believe, or whatever. And they put some straw in the back, and it'd be cold, and we'd wrap up in blankets and go down, and it'd be spitting snow, and they'd pay their grocery bill. And all these little Irish sitting out there waiting, you know, for this candy to come. Then we'd come out, and that candy had to be equally broken among everyone. If there's one stick over, it was broken so many pieces. To be sure, every little blue eye was watching right at it, to be sure he never got cheated. So we'd sit and eat that, and I'd play a little trick on him. We wouldn't eat it, couldn't chew it because it's too valuable. That old stick candy, we'd suck on it a little while and hold it, you know, wait a little while, rest up and suck on it again. Well, I remember I used to play a trick on them. I'd suck on my piece for a while and wrap it up in a piece of paper and put it in my pocket, and I'd have some for Monday. I'd suck on it again and tell all the boys, don't you wish you had some? And I'd just put that piece in the dirt and candy for rolling. And they was good. Now, I guess I could go tomorrow and buy a whole box of chocolates, Hershey's, if I wanted to, but it would never taste like that. That's the real candy. And I remember those old days and how glorious they was, and how that going to school, when school days come along, we went to school, we didn't have any clothes to wear, hardly, just enough that we possibly legally could go. I remember going to school all winter long with one of Mom's shoes on and one of Pop's. That's right, we called it a boot and gagger. And I had one of Mom's shoes on this foot and Pop's. And this is awful to say, but it's the truth. It's the truth. I remember I didn't have any shirt to wear that winter. And Miss Wathan, a rich lady, lives up the road from us, gave me a little coat that had a little eagle emblem on it. And I'd pull that coat up like this and go on to school. I remember sitting up there. It got kind of warm, you know, and the teacher said, William? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, aren't you warm? Better take off that coat. I couldn't take that coat off. I didn't have any shirt on. So I said, well, no, ma'am. I said, I'm just a little bit chilly. They had a great big old stove sitting over there. She said, you ain't taking a cold. You go over and set that stove. Mama. I sat there in a perspiration running down my face. She said, aren't you warm yet? I said, no, ma'am. I was plenty warm, but I couldn't take that coat off. I didn't have any shirt on. And so I remember that spring when I got my first shirt, I had a cousin, a girl, Lucille Hare, my father's sister's child. They came over to visit us, and when she left one of her dresses. And I cut the skirt part off and wore the top part as a shirt. I went to school and had this here little, what is that stuff that runs up and down, you know, like I had to put around the edges of garments? Rickety-rackety or whatever it is. I miss that. Rick, what? Rip rat, and so we all over everywhere, rip rat all over. So that down the hill we'd go, ribbity, 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 ribbity. Well, we wasn't sliding like the rest of the boys, but we were sliding anyhow. We were getting there anyhow in this old dishpan. Well, that was all right. Some of the boys had sleighs, you see. So after a while, the bottom come out of it. So we had no more sleigh. We went out the river, and I got me a big old log, put a wire on it, and pulled it up top the hill. And we'd get on this log and ride. ride down the hill. I never will forget an event taking place there. There's a boy named Lloyd Ford. Brother Graham, everywhere you're at, my associate pastor is here somewhere. Lloyd Ford, he got him a job. That was the time of the World War. So he got him a job selling Pathfinders or something like that, magazine. And he got to wear one of them Boy Scout suits. And everything was a war, and then, you know, an army. And oh, how I wanted to dress like a soldier. I'd see those soldiers come up from the quartermaster and go up the road, just at attention, walking. And at the school, we had an old sassafras pole there and raise the flag, and those soldiers come by with it, salute the flag. I thought, how all my heart just beat. When I get big enough, I'm going to join the army. I get plenty of clothes to wear, and if I can join the army. But when I got big enough, I was too scrawny yet to get in the army, and they wouldn't even take me. But somebody accepted me. That's right. I'm in the army today. You might not be able to see my uniform, but I know it's on anyhow. It's on the inside. I'm in the army of the Lord. And so in the war, I tried to volunteer and everything, but they didn't receive me. So they never even called me. They put me in a minister's class and just never even called me. I guess my education was too poor to be classed as a chaplain. And then being a minister, they didn't draft me. So there I was. I was left out, but somehow or another, my scrawny, uneducated and all, God sent out a recruit one day, and I answered it, and I'm in His army now, and I'm doing the best that I can to fight the greatest battle has ever fought, a wage against sin and evil and for righteousness. And I remember I asked Lloyd, I said, Lloyd, will you give me that suit when you wear it out? He said, yes, I'll give it to you. And that was the longest lasting suit I ever seen. He wore that suit, looked like, I've seen him one time, he came up missing it, and I said, Lloyd, what about that suit? He said, I'll see if I can find it, Billy. Looked all around. He said, no, sir. You know, mother patched Dad's clothes with it, and the dogs used it for a pallet, and they drug it away, and said, the only thing I got left is one legging. I said, bring me that. So his little old stave legging, about like that, laced up on the side. So I took that legging, you know, and I wore it around home, put it on. My, look how good that looked, you know, one legging. Thought, my, that felt good. I wanted to wear it to school, but I didn't know just how I was going to get to wear that legging to school. So I put it in inside of my coat, and I was riding on that log one day, and I went down the hill, and oh, I got up, and I said, my, hurt my leg. I said, my stockings, you know, and great big holes in them, and I said, I just hurt my leg so bad. I said, that just reminds me, I've got one of my Boy Scout leggings here in my coat. I put that legging on. I walked into school, you know, kind of limping like, but didn't everybody look at that one legging? And so I had to go up to work the problems on the blackboard, and so that they wouldn't notice I just had on one legging, I stood sideways and put this legging on that side and stood like this and worked the problems like this. Look out and see if everybody was looking at me. That one legging on, everybody got laughing at me. I got to crying, so she made me come down. But, oh my, something that I got a pair of leggings today that I'm not ashamed of. That's right, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then many great things happened in childhood back there that wouldn't have time to approach. One thing, not long ago, I was having a revival in Texas. I come home and wife, I, and the baby, we went up the road, and I just, so tired, I just felt like I'd drop. I just couldn't stand it. And on the road home, I was driving, and I go to sleep, and I drive about a couple of miles, and I'd stop. I try to sleep, and I'd wake up, and I'd drive a little farther, and I'd get sleepy, and just almost go off the road, and I'd stop. I thought, this is awful dangerous, but I must get home. And I would lay down in my car and try to sleep. I woke up after a while, and you know what had happened? I'd run off the road and was way out in a cow pasture holding my hand out and saying, sister, believe it. That's all you have to do. You get healed if you believe it. Way out there in the pasture. We're running off the road and out through a field there and asleep. And wife and I, there's a great crowd of people waiting there, so we got in the car and went up the road. I passed by the old schoolhouse. It's gone too, for we have no continuing city. And right across from there, there used to be Mr. Watson's chauffeur. And in Combs, they live there. There's a pump that I wanted to drink out of. And I thought, just like David one time, I wanted to drink out of that well. And I went down there to the and began to pump the water, and wife and baby and them were sticking bollocks. I was leaning across the old fence and looked at the old hill there where the school used to be and the old trees, the sugar maples where we used to tap them and suck the sap on them in the spring of the year, knowing when it was coming up. And I thought, oh, I could just imagine seeing all those little boys standing lined up there with their hands on one another's shoulders, tramping like this, and the flag up, and we were going in, the teacher with a great big long willow, make this line up just right, and I look up on the hill and see the old home where it used to be, and the housing project up there. Down here the old school was gone. My heart began to swell. I thought, here we have no continuing city, but we're seeking one to come. I remember the boys that I said, let me think, Ralph Fields, where's he at? He's gone. Where's Howard Higdon? He's dead. Where's my brother? Gone. Here we have no... Where's Dad? Gone. Where's Charles? Gone. Where's Edward? Gone. I thought, oh God, and soon somebody looked at this ground and said, where's Bill? Gone. Here we have no continuing city. I began to think of it. My heart began to pound. I remember a little dirty trick that I done my brother there. Don't do anything wrong that you'll ever regret. I remember one day that Mama gave us some popcorn to take to school with us. We couldn't eat with the rest of the kids. We'd always run over the hill there and eat because the rest of the children could afford sandwiches. And we used to have a little jar. In there would be greens and a piece of cornbread laying on the side and two spoons and maybe a little jar full of stuff, you know. And we'd sit and both of us eat out of this jar with this spoon, eat our bread and pass it back and forth to one another. It was a shame before the children. And we'd run over the hill and eat behind the trees over there. I remember Mama getting us some popcorn around Christmas. We had a sack of it. We took it to school, left it in the cloakroom. And here's a little dirty trick that I did. I held up my hand. The teacher said, why won't we? And I said, may I have an excuse? I said, yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. And I went out the building and went out through the cloakroom. I put my hand down that sack and got a great big handful of that popcorn. Went out and stood behind the school to eat this popcorn to be sure that I got my share of it. And I was eating that popcorn. I never will forget. When dinner time come, we went out and got our bucket and got our popcorn. My brother looked in that sack, about half of it gone. He said, say. He said, something happened there, didn't it? I said, sure did. And I know what had happened. I needed his popcorn. But he shared the rest of it. And standing there leaning over that fence, I thought of all those things. He's the one that's gone on. He died in the hospital calling for me when I was in Arizona many, many years ago. Friend, if I'd have had $100 million laying before me, I'd have given everything that I had if I could have tucked him that handful of popcorn back again. Couldn't do it. Gone on. I thought how hard he had to live. He died when he was just a boy. And how that we tried to share clothes with one another just before he died. Put his hand over his heart and said, I'll never live to see Bill again. But said, tell him he's my favorite brother. And when I'm there, I was thinking about that then. I started crying. My wife said, I want you to come home to rest. And she seen what was going on. So she got me away and we went on up the road. Life went on as a child, as boyhood, out of hurry. When I was a young man, I seen the way women lived. I never did like girls. Never did like women. Because I got enough to see the way they was lived. If anything I respect in a woman is being true. I don't care if she's any colored, white, or whatever she is. If she's a real lady, she deserves the highest of respects. God knows that. And I purposed in my heart when I was a little boy that I'd never have nothing to do with women. And I'd be a hunter all my life, and that's what I did. And I'd live in the woods, hunt all night, and that's where I learned God was by nature. I remember when I got to be about 17 or 18 then, as all boys, some boy friend of mine, his daddy had a car, James Poole, and he had a little girl he wanted me to meet, and you know how you are. I seen that little girl, and I thought she's the prettiest little thing I ever seen. You know, teeth like pearls, eyes like a dove, neck like a swan. Oh, my, this is the prettiest thing you ever seen. So, said, she wants to meet you, Bill. And I said, oh, I said, I don't know how to talk to a woman. I said, I can't do that. And he said, oh, come on. So I talked to her a few times, and after a while, he said, I'll get Dad's old car, and said, we'll take our girlfriends a ride. Oh, well, that wouldn't be bad. So we went out. We stopped down there to get some sandwiches. And I went in and got some Cokes and some sandwiches and come back out. And we eat the sandwiches and I took the Cokes back, the Coke bottles back. When I went back, I come out. To my surprise, my little girlfriend was smoking a cigarette. Well, I always had my opinion of a cigarette-smoking woman, and I haven't changed it yet. It's the most lowest, immoralist, degrading thing that a woman can do. I'm not here to preach the gospel in that manner. Your preacher will do that. But women, if you do smoke, for mercy's sake, get away from it. How cheap it looks in a woman that'll smoke a cigarette. My, it's the cheapest thing. I'd rather see her drunk anytime. And listen, you talk about a sabotage. Don't you worry about Russia coming in and getting us. Russia ain't going to hurt us. We're hurting herself. It's our own moral decay that's hurting us. We're corrupting ourselves. Statistics show, but doctors, I believe, that 80% of the women that have children that smoke cigarettes, if they raise their baby like they should, to the breath, in 18 months it dies. It kills the baby, the nicotine poison in the milk of the mother. Why, sabotage, fifth columnist. I still say what this world needs today is not a new president. It needs an old-fashioned St. Paul's revival and the Bible Holy Ghost back in the church again. I believe that's right. Yes, sir. That's exactly what it needs. And the women, how they would smoke, and I thought that was terrible to see a woman smoke. Well, that just broke my heart. I just couldn't stand that. I didn't want nothing to do with that. So I just left her. And so that was the time when the angel of the Lord appeared to me when she laughed at me, called me a sissy, and made me walk home. That's right. One place she said, well, you big sissy, I wouldn't even ride with you. I said, you don't have to. She said, you don't smoke? And I said, no, ma'am. Said, you don't drink either? And I said, no, ma'am. Said, what do you like to do? I said, go fishing, hunting. Of course, that didn't interest her. So I thought about it anyhow, and I'm glad today that I did think that. That's right. Amen. Listen, friends, it ain't the robin that pecks the apple that hurts it. It's the worm at the core that kills the apple. That's what it's sin in our midst is what's hurting us. That's right. Sin in our midst is killing us. Now, then I guess you wonder how I ever got married. Well, when I met my wife, she was a Christian girl, very lovely Christian girl. And I was then about 23, 24 years old. She's a very sweet, humble character. And I met her, I'd take her to church, and she went to church, and she was a very fine, lovely woman. All these people here, my friends in Jeffersonville sitting here in front of me, knows her, I knew her, and how a lovely woman she was. She's in her grave today. But that's her body, her soul's with Christ. And she was a very lovely Christian character. And I went with her a while, and she come from a good home. Her father, during the time of the Depression, and that was, he made about $600 a month. He was a brotherhood organizer on the Pennsylvania Railroad. I made 20 cents an hour digging ditches. And so I couldn't marry the girl, I didn't think. And I thought, well, if I went with her any longer, I was taking up her time. She's too good a girl to let go. She'd make some man a good wife. So I had to either just let her go or ask her to marry me, and I didn't have nerve enough to do that. So I guess you wonder how I got. I wrote her a letter and asked her if she'd marry me. And I said, well, it wasn't dear miss, will you have me? It was a little bit what you call mushier than that. And I kind of talked to her, but here, I remember, I thought, I've got to do something because it's not right to take the girl's time. So I wrote her a letter, and I went to work that morning. I was working public service company, and I was very nervous about dropping it in the boxes on Monday morning. I dropped it in the box, and all day I thought about it. I thought, tonight, I'll hear from that tonight. Her mother will call me up and rake me over the coals. And I went on. That night is all right. I was to meet her Wednesday to take her over to the church. So I remember then come on towards Wednesday, and Wednesday night I was just nervous. I didn't know what to do. What am I going to do when I get up there? So I asked my mother, Has Hope called? No. Did you get any mail? No. Well, maybe it hung up and didn't even get out of the box. So I thought, something's happened here. So I went up and I blowed the horn outside. And so she come out. She said, come in. Uh-oh. Go get me in there where her mother is now. And then I'm really going to get it. So I said, are you about ready? She said, let's walk to church. Oh, my. So I said, all right. And I went in, and Miss Brownback looked at me and said, hello, Bill. And I said, how do you do? So I was as nervous as I could be. So I thought something's going to happen any time. You know how you feel when you're on them strings. So we went on out, went to church. Honest, I didn't even hear what Brother Davis said that night. He just preached away, and I didn't know what he said. I was scared something was going to happen. And I looked at her, and I thought, oh, my, isn't she pretty? She's going to tell me this is all of it, sure as the world, because I can just tell it. I know she's going to tell me, stay home, Major. So I had it all fixed up what she's going to tell me. And after church was over, we started walking back a pretty moonlight night. We was walking down the street, and I looked up to see the moon shining down through the bushes, went on and on. I looked at her, and I thought, my, I hate for this to be the last night, but I guess this is it. And I walked on and on. I said, how are you tonight? She said, just fine, how are you? I thought, hurry up, lady, tell me something before I faint. Don't get too close to home. We walked on a little farther, and I said, sure pretty nice. She said, yes, it is. I thought, well, what, hurry up, say something. You know, women can just keep you like that anyhow, you know, under that suspense. And I walked on, I thought, well, getting pretty close to home. I said, did you get any mail this week? She said, uh-huh. That was all. I said, did you get my letter? She said, uh-huh. My. I was certainly burning energy then. And I said, well, I said, did you read it? She said, uh-huh. I said, what'd you think of it? She said, it's all right. And I said, did you read all of it? She said, yes, I read all. I said, what'd you think of it? She said, it was all right. Well, we got married. I don't know how. We just got married. So, the next train comes and I had to ask her mother and daddy. Well, I know it was appropriate to do that. So I never will forget Charlie Brumback. He may be sitting right here this afternoon for all I know. And her mother was a very princely sort of a woman, fine woman, but she belonged up in the ranks, you know, and so, but Charlie was just a good old humble brother. I thought I better ask him and let him ask her, you see. So I thought I'd get by the man better than I could talk to the women anyhow. So I said, one night I was leaving, Hope said, have you asked Dad yet? And I said, she said, well, you ought to. I said, I know I should, but I always said, I think it'll be all right. So when I went to leave that night, he said, see you later, Billy. I said, Charlie, I said, could I talk to you just a little bit? You said, I said, come out here just a minute. Walked out a portion, I was just sweating and shaking. He said, I said, Charlie, I said, I want to ask you something. He said, oh, you can have her, Bill. Go on and speak to her. Oh, I love him to this day. I said, Charlie, I can't make her a living like you do. I can't give her clothes like you can buy her. But I promise you this, I love her with all my heart. I'll work till my hands bleed to make her a living, and I'll be as true to her as I know how to be. He put his big hand over on me and said, Bill, I'd rather you'd have her and be good to her than somebody that had a lot of money would treat her mean. I said, thank you, Charlie. We got married. We didn't have nothing to start housekeeping on. The only thing we had, I tell you what we had, a little old place where I rented. My rent cost me $4 a month. And I went into a little old place there, and somebody gave us an old-fashioned folding bed. You remember that old folding bed? Straw mattress, straw tick on it. And we had a little old table we bought from Sears and Roebuck and chairs. We had to paint it ourselves. And so I painted it, and we had two linoleum rugs, got from John Jobbers. That was just a second-hand place down in the Jobbers until I said that John Jobbers so they could catch the benefit of it. And so we got, I think they cost $1.25 a piece. And I went over to Mr. Weber's, he's a junk dealer, and bought a cooking stove. And I gave him $1 and something for it, and I had to pay $1.75 for grates to put in. I got an ice box from the public service company for 50 cents when they took it on swap. We went to housekeeping. But friends, it was just this paradise on earth. We had each other. I'd become converted in that time, become a minister, and was preaching, and I loved the Lord with all my heart, and we loved one another, and that's all we cared for. And listen, happiness does not consist of how much of the world's goods you own, but how contented you are with the portion allotted to you. That's right. Remember that. That's all we had. We were happy and lovely. I had a little church there they built for me. The little tabernacle stands today yet as memorial. And we all, great crowds of people come from far and near around the country to hear the simple gospel. And we were just doing wonderful. And I remember a lovely little boy was born into our home. I called him Billy Paul. I want him to be with me in the next meeting to Carlsbad as soon as we leave Arkansas here. And so he's 14 years old now. And a little later on, 11 months come along, another lovely little sweet thing by the name of Sharon Rose. Just before Billy was born, we had saved enough money that I was wanting to take a little time off. And I went up to Wajack, Michigan to a meeting. And with an old man that had white beard and white hair by the name of John Ryan. And so I went up there, and on the road back, coming back, I seen signs, great crowds of people everywhere when I passed through Mishawaka. I thought, what are those people? And I went over there, and there's some of them in T-model Fords and some in Cadillacs. And they told me that I couldn't get no place to stay. And they said, there's a conference going on here. The Pentecostal people are having a conference. The PA of JC, I believe it was PA of JC, denomination of Pentecost, call that. Well, I've seen all kinds of people. I thought, well, that's a religious meeting. I believe I'll go in. Well, I never heard so much noise in all my life. So, all church manners, they didn't have it. They were screaming, shouting, and carrying on. I thought, what in the world? I looked around there, and it's at a tabernacle. Some of you might know the man's name. His name's Rao, Reverend Rao. Anybody here happen to know Reverend Rao? And yes, someone here knows him. Reverend Rao. It was in his church. Well, they were just clapping their hands and carrying on and dancing. And I said, my, isn't that horrible? People dancing in the church? I said, well, that's a shame. And I was sitting in the seat of the scarfold, sure enough. So I thought, something old kind of got a hold of me a little bit. And I thought, well, now, I counted my money. I had $2.15 left. And I went out and thought, well, now, I can't stay in a tourist court because they ain't got the money. But I'm going to stay over, just got enough money to buy my gasoline to get home. So I went out that night and slept in a cornfield. And I didn't have very good clothes. And the next morning, I went to the service. And that day, all my ministers preaching. And how I noticed that night, because that every preacher comes to the platform, 150 more preachers come up the platform that's having a conference, international conference. And they were all sitting on the platform. He said, we haven't got time for all of you to testify. I went up. He said, just say who you are and where you're from. And he came to me. I said, Evangelist, William Branham, Jeffersonville, sit down. Well, come to find out, I was the youngest minister in the group at then. So then that night I thought, they was bringing all kind of preachers, and it shows an old colored man to bring the message for that night. Real old, just a little rim of hair around his head. He had an old preacher's coat on, that velvet collar, kind of that cutaway coat. Poor old fellow come out to the platform like this. Oh, I felt so sorry, I wanted to get up and help the old man. And he'd come out, and they had to have the conference up there on account of not having it in the South, because they had both colored and white together. And the old fellow was standing there, you know, and all the ministers that day had been preaching on what Jesus done and so forth. But he took his text from over in Job, somewhere there, where he said, where were you when I laid the foundations of the world, and when morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy? Well, where the ministers is bringing the activities of the church on earth, he went up into the heavens back under and comes up back down about 10 million years before the world was ever formed, and come back down the horizontal rainbow with him. And about the time he got down there, he let out a great big hoop and jumped up and clicked his heels together. Said, glory to God, he ain't got room enough up here for me to preach. I looked at that. I said, well, if that'll make an old man like that act like that, what would it do to me if I got some of it? I said, I want some of that. That's what I want. If it'll make an old man like that, well, what would it do for me? So I went out that night in a cornfield, and I began to pray. I said, Lord, let me get some of that. So I said, you give me favor with them people. And prayed away in the night out there in a cornfield. I took had some seersucker trousers. My others was got all dirty there in the cornfield. So I laid them on my seat and took the two seats and put them together out of my car and pressed my trousers that night. And I had my little seersucker shirt. Nobody knew me, so I just laid it down there. Seersucker shirt and a little T-shirt and seersucker trousers, rather. I laid them down there. Next morning, I got up, shined them all up, meeting get at 10 o'clock. We had breakfast after breakfast, and I wouldn't eat with them because I didn't have no money to put in. I just didn't eat with them. But they made me welcome. Everything, I didn't know no one there. But a little fellow, I forget what his name was, he played a violin, a little curly-headed fellow. And so the next morning, I walked in, sat down, and so after a while, I looked over, and another man came in and sat down, a colored man, sat down by me, big bunch of people sitting there. So I was sitting there, and they said, we're going to begin the services, and they was talking, making their, selling literature and whatever they had. And he said, there was a minister on the platform last night by the name of Branham from Jeffersonville. Said he was the youngest man on the platform. We want him to come up and bring the morning message. Mercy. Well, I'd never even seen a microphone. They had a microphone there. I thought, what? Well, I couldn't. Seersucker trousers and t-shirt. I just hunkered down real low like this. He announced again, said, anybody know where William Branham of Jeffersonville? Said, we want him to come up and bring the message. 1,500 people nearly sitting there. Not me before that. I just sat back there. No, sir. This, I was too countryfied to get up there. So I just sat there real low. And so, and he announced it two or three times. Said, anybody on the outside? We're paging for William Branham. I thought, something told me, said, that's what you prayed for last night. If you want to get acquainted with them people, get up there. And Lord, I can't do that. Seersucker trousers and t-shirt. I said, no. So I was sitting there. And when he announced again, this colored man looked over me and said, do you know that man? Oh, my. Talk about on the spot. I said, I know that I had to lie or something or be telling. I said, look, fella, look, I keep this to yourself. I said, I'm he, see? But he said, well, get up there, white man, get up there. I said, no. I said, I got on, look at these pants, shirt. He said, them people don't care what you got on, they want to hear you. I said, look, I can't get up there. I said, I don't, you just keep still. And he said, if anybody knows where, he said, here he is, here he is. Here he is. I thought, oh, my. I just feel my heart, boy, my knees real weak and my arms look like it's going to drop off. Well, this looked like something picked me up, and here I went walking up, business conscious, seersucker trousers and t-shirt. I got up there and I said, folks, I don't know very much about before them preachers who could really preach. Oh, my. I said, I just want to say that I love Jesus and you know, started like that. And so he said, I started to walk off and he said, speak a little for us, Brother Branham. I turned over and I said, I just don't know what to say. And I have to think of a text. And then he cried, the rich man, that when he lifted up his eyes in hell. And I took that text, and then he cried. And I got to speak it, and the first thing you know, something hit me. My, I was lost out of this world for a while. And everybody got to screaming out. Went outside when the service was over, and a great big fellow from Texas with cowboy boots on and a big cowboy hat said, I'm a preacher. I thought, well, brother, my seersucker trousers are not so bad after all. You know, cowboy boots and a big cowboy hat to be a preacher. And he said, I heard you say you're an evangelist. I'd like to sign you up for a couple weeks revival down in Texas. I took his name. I said, oh, my Lord, you're just doing great things for me. I took that all down, you know, a little bitty fellow with these little golf playing trousers on. Walked up and said, I'm from Florida. I'd like to have you over there for a couple weeks. My, I've seen it just common people after all. So first thing, a woman come up to the Indian reservation, wanted me to go there. Well, I had enough invitations last me about a year. My, I jumped in that old Ford, it had backslid, and down the road I went. I rushed in home, wife met me, you know, and I said, oh, honey, I got something to tell you. I met the cream of the crop. I said, my, people who just scream and shout and jump up and down, they're not ashamed of their religion. I said, my, the best you ever seen. She said, where are they at? I told her, I said, look here, I got a whole string here. I said, my, I can just preach and preach and preach it. And you know what? They accepted me. I said, is that right? I said, look, I'm going to quit my job and start right out. She said, well, we haven't got any money. I said, how much money we got? She said, we got that $12 in there in payment on the Ford. I said, well, you know, the Bible said, don't take anything when you go, see? Don't take any scrip, or if you got two coats, give one to your brother. He said, I'll be with you. I said, that's what, he said, I said, will you go with me? She, bless her heart. She said, yes, I'll stick with you. So I went and told my mama, and mama said, oh, it's all right, honey, if you feel that. Well, I went and had to tell her mother, and that didn't work so good. She said, William, she said, she's your wife. You may take her if you want to. But said, I don't want my daughter drug out among that bunch of trash. Trash? Friends, I found out this, that what she thought was trash is the cream of the crop. That's right. And I say that with respect. Said, out like that, we're all that carrying, screaming and carrying on like that. Said, won't you go on up there and be a pastor and someday they'll build you a parsonage? And, well, I didn't. Oh, my. So Hope began to cry. And so I said, well, she said, I'll go with you. But anyhow, I didn't want, she said, how it would have hurt her, so I just let it go. Went on. Friend, the little girl that was too good to be with that trash, I buried her just a little later there. Sorrow set in right there. I'll hurry, just a few minutes. I got left, about 15 minutes. There's where sorrow struck me. Now you let my mistakes be your gain. You prosper, but what I had to suffer for. Sometimes you see me standing on the platform laughing. You don't know what's beneath there. That's right. I tell you, there's been a price paid that nobody knows but God alone. Right away, my wife taken sick. First thing, I lost my daddy. I run over to the house to see him, picked him up in my arms like that. He looked up at me like that. He smiled. A doctor gave him a dose of medicine and killed him. One overdose of strychnine for his heart, and it killed him. Of course, there's nothing said about that. An undertaker covers up the doctor's mistakes anytime. Nothing that I've got against doctors, but I say there's nothing said about that. But some woman here not long ago trusted God out in California for her baby, and it died. And every newspaper and magazine packed it across the country. And at the same time where one didn't have faith enough for deliverance, everybody criticized that, all the magazines and papers. And God heals thousands, and you have to pay them to put it in the paper or something like that. But look here. Let me tell you something. The Bible said, come, let us reason together. Is that right? Listen, the same time that picture was being packed across the country telling people that divine healing can't be trusted and everything like that, the doctor lost thousands times thousands of cases, and there was nothing said about that. Isn't that right? Listen, come reason together. Salt's for the goose, is for the gander, too. Let me tell you, if one person being lost by divine healing with not enough faith to recover, and it's all branded as fanaticism, then if a doctor loses one case, branded fanaticism. Salt's for the goose, is for the gander. Is that right? That's right. But friends, what medical science and ministers ought to get together and cooperate together and know we're all working for the good of the people and for the glory of God and work together. That's what we ought to do. But anyhow, my father, he was killed then with his doctor, gave him an overdose of medicine, and it killed him. And right away, my brother was riding on the side of a car, got his neck broke, died in my other brother's arms. My sister-in-law died. My wife took sick and was, the 1937 flood came up. And there was sorrow. I never will forget it. Wife was laying just at the point of death. I went and I was praying for her, doing everything I knew. And every time I'd pray, it looked like, I went and told my church, I said, she's going to die. Said, no, I said, she's going to die as certain as anything. My babies, both of them were sick. The flood come up and everything, houses breaking over and rushing and miles of water sweeping over the country. And they taken my wife out to the hospital, to the government hospital, a temporary hospital. And I was on patrol duty, and I was riding up and down the streets and trying to get the people out. And I never will forget one horrible night. Oh, God, when I think of it, there, in that critical hour, I had a truck there, a little patrol truck, and I was taking a boat, and I was coming up the road. Somebody said, over on Chester Street, the dike's about ready to break through, and said, there's a woman screaming for mercy over there. Nobody can get to her. Well, I was raised on the river and thought that I could do pretty good with the boat. And so I got the boat and set it in the water and started off. And I looked over there and I heard that mother. It was about 11 o'clock at night just screaming, mercy, help me, help me, standing out on her porch. And I got up there and tried to get the boat across and went way down, come out the other side, the water sweeping down through the street. I went way back again and tried, and finally I hit against the post. And the mother fainted. I picked her up, put her in a boat. Four or five little children. I got them in and went back and finally got to the shore. And just as I got to the shore, somebody said, my baby, my baby. Well, I thought the woman left a little baby in there. And back I went. And just as I got over there, I run through the house, come to find out, the baby, there's a little girl in there about 2 or 3 years old, and that's who she was talking about. And I didn't know it. And I was over there, and the dike broke through up there on Chestnut Street, poured down, and away went the building. And just as I jumped in my boat and had to run my hand in the water to jerk the rope, or my boat, then I got out into the stream and couldn't get it started. On down we floated, got out over on Market Street there. Big waves of dashing against the side. I thought any minute I would go to the bottom. I knew there in that boat, I knelt down. I said, oh God, I know I have disobeyed you. And I believe, friends, if I'd have went on back down there when those people called me in, the gift of healing would have been manifested right there. That was God's program, but I failed to walk in what He told me to do. I listened to what people told me instead of what God told me to do. Don't never do that. You follow what God tells you to do. And then sorrows his own. And I prayed, I said, oh God, I know I've disobeyed you. If you'll just help me, I don't want to die. I don't want to drown out here in this river. Please, God, let this motor start. Will you please? And I'd pull that string and the ice freezing and it'd chug a couple times and that boat ripping and jumping and dashing like that. Done got out into the main current. And I didn't know what was going to happen to me. And I'd try and try and it wouldn't start. And I prayed again. I said, God, my poor wife laying out there sick, my baby's sick, and hear me drowning in the river. Why, oh, God, what can I do? And I said, if you just help me, Lord. And I pulled the string again, and away it went. Oh, my. I was right into the river, out of the river, got on into the, come out way down towards Clarksville. And I come around and got back up and got to my truck. And some of them said, did you know the government just washed out? When that dike broke, out to the hospital, I went as hard as I could. I met a Brother George Deart there. He said, oh, Brother Bill, he put his arms around me. He said, looks like things are close. He said, Brother Bill, if I never meet you again, I'll meet you in the morning. That's the last time I seen him in life. That's right. He left a little afterward. And I said, where's Hope? Said, I don't know. And I went over there and I met one of the officers of the government. I said, sir, what become of the hospital? Said, they all washed through there. And I said, did any of them get drowned? Said, no. They went out on a train to Charleston. And I run and got my car and started out the Highway 62 leading to a little city, Charleston. And when I got out there, there was about 5 miles of water. Done come down through Lancaster Sand Creek and cut it off. I went and got my boat, and I couldn't even pierce that water. I'd start through there and whirl around like this. And I'd set the at this angle and just give it all the gas that I could and hit them waves like that. It was so rough. I'd come around the side of them woods and throw my boat back down this way, and I'd come out down behind the government. And there I was caught on a little island like, and I'd sat there for days up on that island. Thinking, some of them said the trestles went out from under the bridge up there, and everybody that went out on that train was drowned. Wife, two children, and all. Oh, God, how nervous I got. I walked the floors. I didn't know what to do. I thought, oh, what will I do? And they're gone. And after a while, as soon as I could get over the water dropped enough that they could get me across, I got to Charleston. I was looking. I met an old friend of mine. He said, no, that train never washed off. Said, they went through, but I don't know where they're at. I went out and the dispatcher told me, said, a mother and two sick children, I put them off in Columbus, Indiana, but you can't get to them. Said, the water's cut off this side. I started walking back down the road, rubbing my hands, crying, saying, oh, God, take me. Don't let me suffer. Take me, Lord. Don't let me have to go through this agony. Walking down the road, and a man drove up to me in a car. He said, I know what you're looking for. I said, you're looking for your wife, aren't you? I said, yes. He said, don't you know me? He said, I go with Mary Mayo. I said, yes, I remember you. He said, your wife is dying in the Baptist church at Columbus, Indiana. And I said, surely not. I said, yes. I said, she's got tuberculosis. And said, you wouldn't even know her. And the doctor says she's going to die. She's laying right next to my girlfriend. He said, I know how to get you there if you want to go. And I said, well, let's go, brother. And I remember that night when I run into the building up there, the Baptist, they made a hospital. They had army cots everywhere. And I run in there, boots on, where we waited in the water, and I began to scream, Hope, Hope, where are you, honey? Where are you? Just beside myself. Directly, I looked over there, and I seen an old bony hand raise up. It was her. I ran over real quick to her and grabbed her up my arms. I said, is the children alive? She said, yes. She said, I look awful, don't I? I said, no, honey, you look good. I said, my, you're going to be all right. I felt somebody tap me on the back, and it looked like a doctor. He said, come here. He said, are you her husband? I said, yes. Are you Reverend Branham? I said, I am. He said, well, sir, I hate to break this news to you. He said, your wife's dying. So don't get her excited or anything. I said, doctor, surely not. I said, yes. Said, she's going. And I said, oh, what is it? Doctor said, galloping tuberculosis. Said, she'll just die right away. He said, just make her feel good as you can. He said, and both of your babies are sick. I'm tending to them over here in another home. Well, I went back and told her. I said, honey, you look good. And a little doctor friend of mine, Dr. Sam Adair, there in Jeffersonville, as soon as he let me, I brought him back down home. And there, they lay there until the babies got well. The wife gradually went away. Finally, we got her in the hospital. I had doctors to come look at her. There wasn't nothing to be done. She took pneumothorax treatments and everything. Nothing could be done. Now, I remember standing there and they bore holes down through her side and put that tube in there and get claps one lung. Listen, if I had it, she'd hold my hand and cry and the tears rolled down her cheek. She'd look at me, just suffering. Never done her a bit of good. If I had to go over it, never go through with it again. That's right. It's just holding my hand. But just to show you, the way of a transgressor is hard. I never will forget. I was trying to work to get the bill paid off. And then one day I was out, and I heard a call come and said, if you want to see your wife alive, come at once. I rushed out to the hospital. I'll never forget it. I jerked off my hat and threw it in the truck and run up through there real quick. And here come little Dr. Dare walking out. God bless his little heart. He's a fine man. and they come walking out. We'd eat together, slept together, feast together, just bosom friends. And he'd come walking out, through the hospital. And I see him look at me, and I see big tears drop off his cheeks, and he turned sideways. And I run into the room. I said, "What's the matter, Doc?" I said, "She ain't gone." I said, "I believe she is." I said, "Come going with me, Doc." He said, "Bill, don't ask me to do that." I said, "Hope's like my sister." I said, I can't go in there. Don't ask me to." And the nurse came up and said, "Come, Brother Branham." I said, "Here, drink this little bit of medicine." I said, "No, I don't need it." He said, "Go ahead, Billy. That'll rest your nerves." I said, "I don't want it." I said, "No." He said, "Nurse, you go in with him." I said, "No, I don't want anyone. I'm going in myself. I'm going in." I said, "I love her, and I'm going in." I walked the door, opened the door, and there she lay, all covered up like this, and blanket sheet pulled up over her face. I jerked the sheet down, my heart just a breaking. I put my hand on her, her perspiration on her forehead kind of felt sticky. I said, "Hope, Hope, honey." I said, "Speak to me once. Well, just speak one time, won't you?" I was shaking her. Friends, if I live 100 years, I'll never forget what happened. Those two big brown eyes looked up at me. She was so weak she couldn't say nothing. She was smiling. She tucked her finger and she motioned. And I got down and she said, "Well, why did you call me, honey?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." She said, "Oh, I was in another land." She said, "It was so peaceful. I wasn't suffering." She said, "Great big birds like a great orient." And she said, "There was a man dressed in white, one on each side, taking me to my home." Oh, friend, there's a land somewhere. I believe as she was dying, her eyes just opened up to see paradise beyond. She rallied for a little bit. The nurse came in and she said, "Nurse, come over." She said, "I hope when you get married, you have a husband like mine." And I said, "Oh, honey, I haven't done that." She said, "Oh, bless your heart." She patted me on the back. Nurse turned around and walked out crying. She said, "Bill, I want to tell you a few things, but I'm going. So don't cry." I said, "All right." She said, "Don't let my babies be pulled about from pillar to post." She said, "There's some things I got to confess to you." I said, "What is it?" She said, "You remember one time that you were going fishing, and I called you that night. We was going to Fort Wayne for a meeting." I said, "Yes." She said, "You went and got me some stockings." I said, "Yes, I remembered it." She said, "Them was the wrong kind of stockings, honey. Them wasn't right." But what it was, I'd been fishing. I went up home, and we had to go to Fort Wayne. I was going to preach that night at Fort Wayne. Her father lived at Fort Wayne. So I was going up there to preach. And there's two different kinds of a woman's socks that you buy. One's called, is it chiffon? That's right. And what's the other kind? Rayon? Sorry, is it Raymond or Raymond? Rayon? Which is the best? Chiffon. Well, they cost 60-something cents then. And she was taking a bath and she said, "Billy, you run down at Penny's and get me some socks." And I said, "All right." And I was going down the street. And she said, "Now, remember, I didn't know about women's clothes." And she was saying, "Get chiffon." I was going down the street saying, "Chiffon, chiffon, 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 chiffon." Somebody said, "Hello, Brother Branham." I said, "Hello, chiffon, 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 chiffon." And I met Orville Spahn down there. And he said, "Billy, Birch is biting over on about that." Oh, I said, "My, I got talking to him and I forgot about what she said." Well, I wasn't going to Penny's because I didn't know nobody there, but I used to have a little friend that come to my church, the name of Thelma Ford. She worked in a 10-cent store, and I know they sold them over there, and I went over, and Thelma come up and said, "What do you want, Billy?" I said, "I want some socks for Hope." I said, "Now, Hope don't wear socks." I said, "She sure does." She said, "She wears stockings." I said, "That's right. That's right." I thought, "Oh, I've shown my ignorance already." And I said, she said, "What kind do you want?" And I said, "What kind you got?" She said, "I got chiffon and what's it? Rayon's the cheap ones." She said, "I got rayon." I said, "That's what I want. That's what I want." She said, "Hope won't rayon." All sound alike. Rayon, chiffon. I didn't know the difference. She said, "Yes." And so she gave me, got them and put them in the sack. And I said, "I want the full style. You know, that thing got a little thing behind them, you know, that, I don't know. You know," I said, "the full style." Full fashion. That's what it was. I said, "That's the kind that I want." And she got them ready for me. She put them in a sack, and it was only about 29 cents. And I said, "Well, give me two pair of them." And she said, "Are you sure that?" I said, "That's what she wanted." And so I went back, and I, of course, you know how you men like to pop off to your women. And I said, "Looky here." I said, "I'm Abraham's son. I'm a little Yiddish. You go to the river shopping. I'll buy two pair of stockings. Watch, you can buy one, have money left." I said, I'm Abraham's son. I know how to do it. You see, you know, going on like that. God bless her heart. She's in her grave tonight and probably snow over it. But now we're going to there. I still think of her. That's right. And she gone on. And there, when she said, I thought funny when she got to Fort Wayne, she wanted another pair of stockings. But she was lady enough not to say it. And she told me, she said, Billy, I give them to your mother. They was for an older woman than me. And I said, well, God bless you, honey. I didn't know that. I said, that was all right. She said, you remember that time you wanted to go hunting so bad and we was in Louisville? You seen that little 22 rifle that you wanted and it cost $3 and something to pay down on it and you didn't have the money to pay on it? It's been about 2 years ago. And I said, yeah, I remember that. She said, Bill, I've always wanted to buy you that rifle. She said, I won't be with you but just a few minutes longer now. But she said, when you go home, look up on top of the old phone in bed under that paper. I've been saving nickels to buy the rifle. She said, will you promise me you buy it? Oh, my. When I went home and found that $2 and something laying over there, like to kill me. I said, sure. But I said, honey, you're not going on it. She said, I hate to leave you, but said, I must. She said, I don't mind it. She said, it's all right. So now another thing I'm going to ask you. Don't stay single. I said, oh, don't ask me. She said, promise me. Promise me that you won't stay single. My children have a home to go to, not be drug around everywhere. I said, honey, I can't do that. And she said, promise me. She said, I can go a little easier. And she didn't mind more than you mind taking a drink. She said, I just said, I hate to leave you and the babies, but she said, oh, Bill, it's so wonderful to go like this. And I said, well, I'll do the best I can. And she said, another thing. She said, you realize why I'm going, don't you? Oh, that's what hurt. She said, if I wouldn't have listened to Mama and would have listened to, said it would have been different, wouldn't it? I said, that's right, honey. I said, oh, what will I ever do? She said, do this. Don't be ashamed of this Holy Ghost religion. She said, it's the greatest thing in the world to die by. She said, stay and preach as long and said, promise me you'll go right out into the fields where we were supposed to go. And said, promise me that you'll do everything you can. Said, tell everybody that it's glorious when you get ready to leave here. It's wonderful. And I said, oh, honey, it's so good to see you go like that. And she said, I said, where do you want me to place you? And she said, you take me up on the hill. I said, I'll take you up on Walnut Ridge. And I'll bury you up there at the hill, your body. And I said, honey, I promise you, I'm going, if God will spare me, I'm going right out into the field and I'll never stop until the last drop of blood or life is gone from my body to do or try to make an atonement. And I said, I'll do everything that I can to live right. I'll do right. And I said, look. And she said, goodbye. I said, are you going? I said, look. On that morning, I said, so we'll be able to get together now. I said, if on that morning, I want you to go to the east side of the gate. And I said, I want you to stand there. And when it'll be terrible down here. I said, if I die before he comes, I'll be sleeping out there. I said, we'll get together. But if I'm somewhere on the field and be taken up, I said, you go there and wait for the children and stand there by the side of the gate. And then when you see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob coming in, start screaming, Bill, Bill, just as loud as you can. I said, I'll answer you there. She raised up her feeble hands. I kissed her goodbye. That was my last date with her. I'm on my road. That's right. Someday, I shall go. When we took her down to the funeral parlor, I went home. I couldn't be satisfied nowhere. I went over to Mama's. I was crying. I went home. And they said, Mama said, stay over here. I said, no, I'm going home. We didn't have no friends here, but what it was ours. And so I went home to lay down. And just then, Brother Frank Roy come up, said, Billy, I hate to tell you something, son. I said, well, I was just right there. He said, that's not it. Your baby's dying, too. I said, can it be? He said, yes, it is. And away they took me out the hospital to see my little Sharon, my little girl. I couldn't call her. I wanted to call her a Bible name. I called my little boy Billy Paul, after me and after St. Paul. And then I wanted to call the baby a Bible name. I couldn't call her the Rose of Sharon, so I just called her Sharon Rose. And I went out to the hospital, and the doctor met me, and he said, Billy, she's dying, don't go in there. And I stood there at the leg, the nurse turned her back, and I run down there, and I went down to where she was at. I looked at her, and there's a little thing laying there I never will forget. She's just 8 months old. And I remember I used to come home. She'd sit out in the yard, and I'd blow my horn, and I'd come around the corner, and she'd go, goop, 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 just read. I just love those little fellows. And she was suffering so hard, one of her little fat legs was moving up and down in a spasm, and looked like her little hand was waving. And I looked at her, and I said, Sherry, honey, you know Daddy? And I was trying to make myself strong, and I said, you know Daddy, honey? And her little lips got to quivering, and when she looked at goodness, she was suffering so hard till her little eye went crossed. Oh, my. When I seen that tender little blue baby eye crossed, I didn't know it then. But I understand now there's never been a cross-eyed child coming alive. Well, I think of that. There's never been one pass over the platform but what's been healed, too. I didn't know the crushing had to bring it forth. But I never think of it. See that? That little eye crossing as she was suffering so hard. I knelt down and I said, oh, Jesus, please, God, I'm sorry for what I do. I said, don't take her from me. I love her, Lord, with all my heart. Please, God. It looked like a big back curtain come falling down. I knew she was gone. I raised up, put my hand over her head. I said, God bless you, my darling little sweet angel. I'm going to put you in the arms of Mother. The angel is coming to pack you home in a few minutes. But someday, Daddy will see you. I raised up my head and I said, God, you gave and you've taken away. I don't know why you're slaying me. I said, yet you may slay me. I'm going to trust you. Job did. I'm going to believe you. I said, somehow you're breaking my heart. I don't know how I'm going to hold up any longer. But I said, God, I commit her little soul to you. Take it, Lord Jesus. Put it on the altar with the mother, and someday let me come to see them. And as I did that, the angels of God sweetly come down and taken away her little breath and bore her away to be with her mother. I placed her in, well, the mother, put them down beneath the ground. When I stood there, Brother Smith, the Methodist preacher, a friend of mine, he got some cloths in his hand, walked over there, and I was standing there. He put his arm around and said, Billy, brace up, honey boy. I said, oh, Brother Smith, my soul is I don't know what to do. And I heard him say, with them old clods dropping up on the little casket, said, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, earth to earth. Oh, God, what can I do? Sound like the wind blowed down through the pine trees. It sounded like I heard a song saying, there's a land beyond the river that we call the sweet forever, and we only reach that shore by faith degree. One by one we gain the portal there to dwell with the immortal. Someday they'll ring the golden bells for you and me. I turned from the grave brokenhearted, went home, I couldn't rest. Days passed, I could give up my wife, but that, oh, that baby, it was a choice in my heart. I didn't know what to do. Little sweet girl. And then I thought, oh, what will I do quickly now? One day, I was working for the public service. I climbed up a pole early one morning to take off a pole meter. I was standing there and I was singing, on the hill far away stood an old rugged cross. I happened to look at the sun come up, me hanging there on that pole working on these cross arms. Looked out on the side and there looked like my figure wiggling on that, looked like a cross out there. I thought, oh, Christ of God, yes, it was my sins nailed you there. I'm sorry for what I do. Oh, I said, God, how could you ever put up with a person like me? You broke my heart. You ground me down. But what can I do? And I got real nervous. I had on a pair of rubber gloves that you lineman knows, test for 2300, running right by me around the primary. And I thought, looky here, I can lay my hand on that primary, and in 1 minute's time, I'll be with Sharon. I jerked my glove off. I said, God, I've lost my mind or something. I said, Sherry, honey, I can't stand it no longer. Daddy's coming to be home with you. I said, look at them, 2300 running there, break every bone in your body, electric. I said, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. And the first thing you know, I was sitting down on the ground. I don't know. I believe if that gift had been foreordained, that had been the end of your Brother Branham right there. But God had something else to do. He had to grind that heart out and let him know, let me know that he's the one who rules and reigns. I went home. I couldn't stand it. Couldn't work. Went over to Mama's. Mama said, honey, come in. Let me make you quiet. I said, I'm going home. I went home. It was kind of cool weather. I took the mail out of the box and went around. I was trying to batch. We didn't have much in our house. I had an old cot set back there. But she'd lived there with me. We'd been together. That had been our home. And it, no matter how little it was, it belonged to her and I. It was us. Our whole thing would have been $3 for the furniture. But it belonged to her and I. It was worth as much as any of the good homes there is in the world, because it was ours. And I went back there in the kitchen, cold frost coming up through the floor, and I never will forget, I opened up the mail. The first mail I opened up, it said on there, Miss Sharon Rose Branham. It was her little Christmas saving. The banker knew that she could never draw it, so $1.80 said, he sent it to me, and oh, I just couldn't, and I broke down and started crying. It was getting towards night. I knelt down on the floor, and I started crying and praying, and I, oh, what an hour. I couldn't hardly stand it. I went to sleep. Laying there, I dreamed. I thought I was out west. And when I was out west, I was walking down through the prairie, and I was whistling that song. The wheel on the wagon is broken. Sign on the ranch for sale. I was whistling like that, and I seen an old prairie schooner, and the wheel broke down. And standing there by that schooner stood the most beautiful blonde-headed girl, her pretty blue eyes shining, dressed in white. I had on a hat, and I passed by. I said, how do you do, miss? And put my hat back like that, and she said, hello, Dad. And I looked around, and I said, Dad? She said, sure. I said, well, young lady, I beg your pardon. I said, you're as old as I am. How could I be your daddy? She said, Daddy, don't you know me? And I said, no, ma'am, I'm afraid I don't. She said, you just don't know where you are, Daddy. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, where's Billy Paul? That's your little brother. And I said, what is it? She said, Daddy, on earth, I was your little Sharon. I said, Sharon? My baby? She said, yes, Daddy. I said, remember, we're immortal here. When we come here, we're not little babies no more. We're all one age. And I said, oh, honey, are you Sharon? She said, I said, where's Mother? Said, she's up at the new home. I said, a home? Said, yeah. I said, well, honey, there's something wrong here. I said, Branhams never have homes. We're more like vagabond people. I said, we don't have no home. She said, but Daddy, you got one up here. I looked around over to my right, and there was a great, big, beautiful home, and there was light shining up all around. She said, Mother's waiting for you. I'm going to wait here for Billy. I said, all right, honey. I took out running as hard as I could, my hat in my hand. I run right up to the step. When I got there, Hope would usually meet me, come out with her arms out. And I went up and run up the steps as hard as I could. Now I got up top of the step. Here she come, dressed in white, that black hair hanging down. She come running up to me. She raised out her arm. I run to her, throw my hat down, just knelt there on the side of her. She put her hand on my head. She said, Bill, what are you worried about, honey? I said, oh, Hope, I can't stand it any longer. I said, I see, is that Sharon Rose down there? She said, yes, Bill. She said, what you worrying about? You worrying about me and Sharon? And I said, honey, I just can't stand it. She said, stop worrying. I said, don't worry. We're lots better off than you are. And I said, that may be so, but I said, Hope, didn't she make a pretty woman? Aren't we proud of her? She said, sure. She said, aren't you tired? And I said, honey, I've just been preaching and praying for the sick so long, and that's the way I know I'll go. It had to come. It hadn't come yet. I said, I've just been preaching and praying for the sick to them so tired I can't hardly stand up. She said, won't you sit down? Now I looked, and there was a great big Morris chair sitting there. I looked at her, and she looked back at me. She said, I know what you're thinking. Down here one time, we had them three old chairs, or two old chairs at the house, and